Well, I think that we're so pleased to have Paul Nitter with us today, who, in my experience, has been a foremost name in the interfaith intercultural dialogue for many, many years. And I wonder, Jim, if you could introduce Paul in more detail and begin our discussion.
I'm very pleased that Paul is here. We've been friends for a long time. Paul is a member of the Peace Council. He's a trustee of the Peace Council. With me, with Sally King, who has been here before on these calls. Paul is Professor Emeritus of Theology from Xavier University in Cincinnati. He is currently the holder of the very prestigious, he will demur, but the prestigious Paul Tillich Chair in Theology at Union Theological in New York. He is one of the great voices for theological voices for interreligious pluralism. He is the author of many books, including No Other Name, One Earth, Many Religions, On the Theology of Religions, and most recently, Paul, correct me if I'm wrong, Without Buddha, I Could Not Be Christian.
Right.
And many other books, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Paul is also a longtime member of the board of CRISPAS, CRISPAZ, Christians for Peace in El Salvador. So really thrilled to have Paul here. And it's interesting that our panelist, Alan Race, is also, of course, Joe Elder is another panelist from the Peace Council. And Alan and Paul have been longtime colleagues, and Alan is another major world voice on religious pluralism, the idea that more than one religion may very well have been true. So.
Wonderful. Jim, are you still there?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I think that we should move right into the discussion today because the sooner we get going, the more juice is going to float up. So let's go.
Okay, great. Paul, we've begun these conversations with the Peace Counselors, and I think we will every time, by asking if you can, just so people get a better sense of what this remarkable organization, the International Interreligious Peace Council, what it's all about, can you take a moment and recall a favorite moment or a favorite highlight of your experience with the Peace Council?
Yeah, very good question, Jim. There's been so many in this organization that I've just felt so privileged to be part of, a group of religious leaders who gather in order to provide an interreligious contribution to the nonviolent resolution of conflict. I've learned so much from it. But I think perhaps one of the most moving, or I could even say jolting, sobering experiences that I had was in the first meeting that I attended, which I think was back in 1996, when the Interreligious Peace Council was meeting in Chiapas, Mexico, trying to listen to both sides and bring both sides together on the part of the Mexican government and military on the one side and the indigenous peoples focused around the Zapatista movement on the other. And this was, it was at the end of our a week, or a little more than a week, in which we had been meeting with both sides, really witnessed the sufferings of the indigenous people, and we were all gathered around a table, all the peace counselors and the trustees, to try to formulate a public statement, a kind of press release. And we Christians, as well as the Jews, as well as the Muslims, were saying how important it is that we come out with a strong voice to denounce the policies of the Mexican government and to denounce the policies and actions of some of the military procedures, and how important this is. This is such a vital part of what religions do. And then all of a sudden, one of the Buddhist representatives on the Peace Council spoke up very clearly, very humbly, but as I said, very clearly, and said, but we Buddhists, we don't denounce. That's something we don't do. Well, so there it was, That was such a powerful example of interreligious conversation, dialogue, which is focused on how to resolve the issues of conflict, violence, and peacemaking. We had two very different approaches, Christians insisting that they must denounce, Buddhists saying, no, we can't denounce. I can't go into the details of that conversation, but it was one of the richest interreligious dialogues that I have ever participated in. Because, I'll speak as a Christian. I don't want to speak for the Buddhists, but I learned so much from the Buddhists. I imagine much of what I learned you talked about with Sally King in the first session of these conversations. But that was the most memorable example of interreligious engagement for peace in my experience with the Peace Council.
And you talk about that, Paul, first, that in your Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian.
Yeah.
Your book, yeah.
Right.
And it is interesting how much this brings back our conversation 2 weeks ago with Sally King, who was remembering a moment in Jerusalem on Holocaust Day when we were hearing a conversation about remembering and never forgetting,
yeah.
and we were all nodding. You were in the room as well.
Yeah.
And suddenly the Buddhist said, well, wait a minute. Why remember? Why hang on? Why not let go, forgive, and move on? A very, very different point of view.
I think this really illustrates that interreligious dialogue, conversation, is richest. It's most difficult, but it's also richest on the areas where there are differences, not primarily on the areas where we agree. It's where we differ that we can most learn from each other.
Well, this feeds right into the next question that I wanted to ask, which is that it grows out of the fact that you've been involved in interreligious and intercultural engagement. It's safe to say that all involved in one way or another in interreligious and intercultural engagement in a very serious way. Why is that so important? And specifically, to get us closer to what we're talking about today, Paul, why is it so essential? Why is interreligious, intercultural engagement, that reaching out to the other, why is that so essential to the struggle for social and economic justice, for universal human rights?
Well, really, there are two questions there, Jim, two very related questions, but two questions. Why is interreligious, intercultural engagement in itself so important? That being the first question, the other than why is it important for social justice, work for social justice. I think on the first question, Jim, I guess the answer would come on different levels, on a religious level, moral level, and maybe the political or geopolitical level. On the religious level, this is my opinion, but it's the conviction of many religious people, is that... It's kind of simply put, I'll quote a little something I saw on a T-shirt the other day. God is too big to fit into any one religion. God is too big to fit into any one religion. And I think that in that simplicity is that the realization that religious people have that the truth that they have experienced, however they call that truth, God, Nirvana, Tao, ultimate reality, however it is termed, that truth is always more than any human being can grasp. So I think one of the primary reasons why this kind of conversation is so important is so that each of us can share the truth that we know, so that all of us can grow in the truth that we do not yet have. And I think that's
really an
example of people engaged in dialogue. They find that they are that their grasp of truth, of God, of spiritual reality is both intensified in what they already have, but it's expanded into what they do not yet have. So that I think is the religious reason. The moral reason is that we're living in a world where we are becoming aware more and more of two truths or two challenges, that we are ever more appreciating how different we are, and because we are different in our religions, in our ethnic identities, in our backgrounds, in our experiences, and those differences are very, very important. They can't be lost. They can't be just washed away into some kind of a common stream. And yet, those differences have to be the materials out of which we build ever greater community. And I think, is what interreligious, intercultural dialogue intends, to help the world realize that differences are the building blocks of unity. And if they're not the building blocks of unity, they will become the origins, the springboards to conflict. So I think that, and that leads us into the political necessity of interreligious and intercultural engagement, is that, my God, look around the world today and you see the growing role of religion in international relationships, in geopolitical relationships. And I think the way Rabbi Jonathan Sacks put it in his wonderful book, The Dignity of Difference, he says, nowadays we're realizing that if religions are not part of the solution, they will continue to be part of the problem.
Right.
Because they are part of the problem. And in the way religion is being used to foster violence, and the only way we're going to be able to offset that problem, that abuse of religion, is to get religious people engaged to do something about it. So, that would be the importance of inter-religious conversation in itself. And then briefly, I'm talking too long here. That's what happens when you ask a professor a question.
Keep going.
But it's when you say, why is it important for social justice and for human rights? Well, again, it's rather basic, but it's a basic reality that I think we all too often, the politicians and philosophers and political scientists of the world, maybe fail to forget, that when we say we want to strive for human rights and for justice, we are striving for realities that are based on values. Values
right,
that
exactly.
People hold closest to their hearts and that are part of their feelings. And those values, for many, many people in the world, not for all, certainly not, but for many people, those values are grounded in their religious beliefs. So if you're going to get people on board in a common, coordinated, ever more coordinated, but inter-ethnic and international effort to work for ever greater justice and for the protection of human rights, you better be able to appeal, you have to appeal to their religious values. So I think that's being recognized more and more, even by entities that have tended to shy away from religion because it gets too complicated. I'm living here in New York, and I'm closer and working with the United Nations, that more and more people in the United Nations are recognizing that they have to take on the reality of religion in their work, in their efforts to promote international peace.
Well, I'm reminded of the work with the Global Ethic. You've been involved in that as well. A document that came out of the first modern parliament in 1993. For all that religions differ in their forms, religions share, as you've been saying, they share that bedrock of common values. So it is possible and reasonable to talk about a global ethic, to talk about the fundamental ethical principles to which we can all give our affirmation and our assent. On that notion, though, let me move ahead. And here's a risk. I'm going to ask a professor who knows more about interreligious pluralism than most people to comment on interreligious pluralism. Can you tell us, if we're hearing that term for the very first time, what does that mean? I have here briefly, Paul.
Yeah.
Can you tell us briefly what that means? And then I'm going to ask you, how is pluralism related to interreligious and intercultural engagement? That can be part of
yeah.
your answer.
Pluralism is, I think, a person is a pluralist when he or she recognizes that that it is essential for the human project to recognize that everybody has a very important word to speak, but that nobody has the final word to speak. I think that is about as simple as I could put it, that if we're all going to move towards what we hope will be a better world, to a greater understanding of our human predicament, of our environmental predicament, we're going to have to draw on the wisdom of many people and many cultures and many religions. This idea of many is essential. But pluralism would add, but in this mix, in this conversation, there is no one religion that has the ultimate, the final, the absolutely superior word over all others. That's, I think, what pluralism means. So it calls for engagement, but it also calls for humility.
I asked Marcus Braybrook last week which he thought was the likelier scenario, that is spreading fundamentalism or broadening interreligious pluralism for the future. And I mean the fairly near future, not in the I've been fond of saying lately, in the lifetime of a child born today, what is she likely to see, more pluralism or more fundamentalism? I know my answer.
Yeah, well, Jim, I think, when we look at what's going on in our world today, I think that people are recognizing this vast diversity of viewpoints, and that is becoming threatening. And so many people, in their fear of the other, in their fear of diversity, are retreating into their own, behind their own walls, and trying to build those walls higher, and trying to say that what they have behind these walls, their own territory, is the best or the only place to live. That is the reality of fundamentalism. I think fundamentalism does not result from religion in itself. It results from fear, of losing one's own identity. But as soon as people do that, as soon as they do build up their not as soon as, I shouldn't be so certain about this, but so often it happens that the higher we build our walls, the more we realize, A, that we are cut off from vital resources for our own well-being, and secondly, the more we realize that there's always something that's going to be able to either break down or come over those walls. We can't protect ourselves from others. So I would say that as the world goes forward, the growth of fundamentalism is itself becoming the occasion for people to realize that this is not the way to go. When you see the results of fundamentalism in the area of violence, when you see the results of fundamentalism in the areas of disrespect for others, these attitudes are in itself eating away at the very foundations of fundamentalism. And I think some recent statistics, even among the so-called really very strongly hardcore fundamentalist Christian churches in the United States, that there is a growing depletion of their numbers. More and more young people, more and more so-called young fundamentalists are just starting to recognize that the attitudes that their parents have given them just aren't working. Attitudes towards other religions, attitudes for people of different sexual orientations, they're realizing that just this isn't working. So my hope, it's certainly my hope, but it's also my careful, I think, assessment, I hope it's an assessment, that if Martin Luther King Jr. used to say the arc of history bends towards justice, I would say it also bends towards pluralism.
Well, I told you that I had my answer already in mind, and that's certainly it, although much more articulately put. Let me slightly change the subject. There's something you and I talked about, and we've talked about it before, but recently we spoke about the idea of the global commons. And for people that are hearing about that for the first time, I think this is a new dimension of the emerging global conversation about human rights and social and economic justice. And when we talk about the global commons, what we mean is it actually comes from that old medieval notion of the village commons, the area that was held in common by all. It might include the forest, the pasture land, the green of the village, and so on. And we could all hunt there, we could gather there, we could pasture our flocks there, and so on. And gradually, the commons was enclosed. It was shut down. It was taken over by the lord of the manor, and ordinary people were shut out. So today, the struggle to preserve the global commons is the struggle to preserve the common heritage of humankind. That ranges from the physical, just to say a few more words, the physical, which would include the atmosphere and outer space and the oceans, the land, natural resources, mineral resources, but also cultural resources like the literature, the rights to literature, the internet itself, the idea of commoditizing and closing off the internet, making it entirely a for-profit venture, and finally, things that are a little harder to pin down, like the rights to DNA, to ethnobotany, to cultural wealth and cultural resources, language, spiritual teaching, and so on. And there's a great deal of new thinking about how to define the global commons, how to protect it, new legal structures, and so on. And Paul, I know that you're familiar with this whole area of struggle. I think it's going to be more and more important in the years to come. It's really beginning to explode. And I wonder if you could say a few words about that as a powerful theme or issue for interreligious and intercultural engagement. It seems like we really can't protect the global commons unless we do it in a global way. And I'd just like to also suggest, just drop the hint to everyone, that it seems like this issue of the global commons might be a particularly powerful one for local action. Local action on the global commons. Anyway, that's a lot of stuff to think about, Paul, but can you give us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, right. Well, Jim, you laid it out very, very clearly, very eloquently. I guess, you know, what we're talking about with in our recognition of the global commons is it kind of boils down to this, that there is that which belongs to all of us, a lot of things that belong to all of us, and we can, each of us, flourish only when all of us share in it. I mean, that's the basic message, that unless we share that which, in a sense, belongs to all of us are going to have problems. So this,
right.
I think, really is, in order to ground this idea, to promote it, it really, and again, I don't want to say that religion is necessary for promoting the project of a global commons, but it sure, it seems to me, can offer some very, very useful help. Because I think within all the religious traditions, and here one has to be careful when one says all, I know that, but I think in there is a fundamental message or a fundamental conviction in all the religions. It's expressed in different forms. And whether the form or the symbol is God or Brahman or Tao or the interconnectedness, all the religions recognize there is that which is the source or the ground of all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And that in one sense, we are all commoners. We are commoners in the sense that we are part of that reality. And that reality, I think, one of the reality, the commonness of ultimate reality is the ground of the reality of what we call the global commons. And so the more the people can plug into this deeper spiritual reality that is the source of and the call for sharing of the global commons, I think the more we will have a very important, if not decisive, resource in promoting our concerns for the global commons. Because
I was really delighted. Oh, sorry.
Pardon?
Go ahead.
Because in a sense, any economic policy or any economic system that says I can take part of the earth, I can take part of what we're calling the global commons and use it only for myself, no matter what effects the way I use it has on others. Anyone who says that I can have private property to the point where I can do with it whatever I want and I don't have to care, that it contradicts the message of all the religious traditions of the world.
I think that's very powerful, and I started to say I was delighted to hear you use the term commoners. People that are hearing about this for the first time might not be aware, but that term is the term that is used more and more. We commoners must come together across our we have differences that separate us, cultural and religious, and yet we are all common inheritors of the global commons. We are together. We are commoners, and that bond is an important. I think that's a term that's going to catch on and be meaningful. Let me, Paul, first of all, I'm not sure but for everyone else, but once in a while you're breaking up. I just want to make sure that if you have a wireless phone, you're staying close to your base.
Okay.
No, I think the sound is okay.
Okay, good. Well, it's...
It might be.
It probably is, given our record here.
You know, Jim, one of the things that I wanted to interject in relation to what Paul was talking about was that this relationship between socio-political and economic concerns and the deeper-seated roots of people's value systems, in that regard, it seems that we could talk for decades or generations about how to share equitably resources from the point of view of an economic or a political paradigm and get nowhere. But when you actually begin having the conversation from the point of view of shared values, which is most deeply rooted in people's religious identities, that you could reach some kinds of consensus and commonality, as you're saying, long before you could ever settle agreements at a more superficial level.
I think that's great. Paul, would you want to respond to that?
Right. No, I mean, I think that indeed, it's exactly right, that we can reach such shared agreements or feel the sympathetic vibrations between our different religious values, where they do enter into sympathetic vibration with each other, and realize that we can act together. Then, at that point, it becomes important, even though it will always be difficult, then together as an interreligious community, as a multi-religious effort, to make the connections between our values and our economic systems and our political systems and our governments. In other words, the importance of making connections between our religious values, and now we can even say they are our inter-religious values, and what is being decided in Washington or what is being decided on the global market, to make those connections between religion and politics, between religion and economics. I think it's vitally important. But the first step, right, is to realize that we are in solidarity, a solidarity of values.
I think that's very powerful. I have a question that bears on that, I think, directly. The idea of shared values and the evolving values. And this, I should say also, Paul, has been a part of the backdrop, the background radiation, if you will, of this call. We have materials, background materials for each of the calls that are on the web link that was emailed to participants that you can find at the agnt.org website. And for each of the one-page sort of background material sheets, it includes a brief passage from my book on cultural evolution. We've been making reference to it. And it's interesting to me to look at this call and see that several of the people that I talked most closely with and at greatest length as I was developing that idea of cultural evolution are on this call. Harold Kazimoff is here, and Alan Race is here, and Paul, you are here, and you certainly went through several iterations of that book and that idea, and Barbara, you as well. So let me just put this question to you. Paul, you and I have often discussed my argument and the argument that we live in an age of dramatically accelerated cultural evolution. If that's so, and by that I simply mean our values, as we've been discussing, our values are slowly, maybe even dramatically, moving in the direction of a closer fit with reality. We get over the notion that patriarchy makes sense. We gradually get over the notion that the earth is unfragile. We gradually get over the notion that it's possible to live without social justice and human rights. What is all that? If that's really happening, how does that bear on the struggle for social justice? Is there reason for activists to be encouraged in these times? We're all familiar with the picture of the discouraged, burnt-out activist. But isn't there reason for people who have really made the commitment to building a better world to find some encouragement in this day and age?
A lot of them are on this call today, by the way.
Yeah.
Give them some hope.
I've got to give it to myself, yeah. Yeah. You know, I think I just, to make my comments just as briefly as I can, maybe on two or three levels. On the first level, I think what you're talking about, Jim, and what so much has been of the discussion nowadays is that, I mean, I do believe, as you do, in the reality of evolution. Evolution, not that it's just a steady stream, incorrigible stream towards ever greater progress, no, but that there is an evolution of ever greater possibilities for progress, for change, for betterment, for greater human and environmental flourishing. And I think I agree with you that we are at a point where we can recognize that we have come to an instance in our human history where there are opportunities before us that were not there before. That's the reality of evolution. There are opportunities before us that were not there before, and that maybe, just maybe, I would cross out the maybe and say certainly, but I want to be careful here, but maybe, just maybe, we are at a threshold where there can be some real change. And I think it is this, if I may quote a recent a writer that I think is pointing us to something very real. We're coming to a point. I'm talking about Robert Wright in his some recent books on the evolution of God and non-zero sum, about coming to more and more realizing that we have come to a point where we have to move from zero sum relationships, you know, win lose relationships. If I'm going to win, you're going to have to lose, to relationships where we can make it possible for both sides to win. That's the threshold we're at. And I think it's there because there's greater communication, because of technology. That's a primary, perhaps the primary reason. But the second reason why this threshold is standing before us so both so invitingly but at the same time so menacingly is because we are realizing that if we don't move in this direction, we can really mess up creation. I mean, both in the environmental situation, as well as the kind of weaponry that we have now, that now more than ever, we have the opportunity and we have the urgency to really move into this threshold and to explore working together, always together. No one has the final word, but everybody has a word that we can move towards greater resolution. And I must say, you don't want to hold up any one historical instance and absolutize it. But I must say, what has gone on in Egypt recently is a tremendous source of encouragement. That here again, people have come together, resisted oppression, in working out of their values a collaborative effort, and really made a difference.
Well, I think I wanted to bring that up as we have about 2.5 minutes left, that this stirring, this incredible thirst for democracy, and I'm glad you stressed the bravery, especially of the young people that took to the streets. What's remarkable is that this is happening in Tunisia, in Algeria, in Yemen, in Morocco, in Jordan, in Egypt as well, and even if it doesn't spread, for example, to Syria or Saudi Arabia, I think you can be absolutely certain that those very harsh and repressive governments are sitting up and taking notice. And I think what's really intriguing that bears on our conversation is that those young people, and not just because of the Facebook connection, but those young people are across those countries are speaking a common language that would not be unfamiliar to us. They're talking about democracy, they're talking about human rights, social justice, the rights of women, they're talking about relations with other religions. I thought it was so interesting that Muslims and Coptic Christians were side by side in Egypt. So quite remarkable. We just have a minute or so left, Paul. You'll have another chance to give us final thoughts at the end of this, but there's something you'd like to say to wind up, maybe to encourage all of those on the phone who are involved in this kind of struggle at the local and regional level.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think again, let me appeal to what has gone on in Egypt. I mean, and that was a national movement of Egyptians, you know, throughout their country. But I think what they did nationally is the same dynamic that is possible locally. Namely, they all faced, all of those average suffering, suffering because of injustice, because of oppression, they had a common problem. They came together in their great diversity, economic diversity, as you pointed out, Jim, religious diversity, and their common suffering, their common problem brought them together to achieve something incredible. That same dynamic is possible in our local communities, namely our local communities which throughout the world, and I'll speak especially for the United States, I know it's the same in England, even perhaps even more so, we are a multi-religious community. The more our local communities, our local neighborhoods, which are multi-religious, can come together and recognize that despite our religious differences, we have common problems. We have common issues that we have to deal with. And the more we can come together to deal with issues that are common, the more we will experience that, my God, despite our differences, or maybe because of our differences, we can form a collaborative, multi-ethnic, multi-religious solidarity that will make a difference both for the world in removing the suffering, but also make a difference in our interpersonal and our interreligious relationships, in which we realize more and more that within our differences there is that which holds us together, as primarily as humans, secondarily also as believers.
Paul, I got to thank you so much. That's really fantastic. I'm sure everyone really enjoyed that conversation. Stay with us.